Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Coercive Control in Children's and Mothers' Lives by Emma Katz, narrated by Catherine Anderson. Preface. 7-year-old Roxy hugs her mother as she cries. Dad has locked them in the house and stormed off again, and they can't get out until he returns. How long will he be gone this time? Roxy is upset. Dad is always doing horrible things like this. The first time he hit her, a couple of years ago, he said that she was just like her mum because she answered him back like mum did. He said that he would beat it out of her just like he beats it out of her mum. Since then, Roxy has felt scared at home. She stayed quiet and been more careful around Dad. Dad often says nasty things to mum in front of her. He calls mum bad names like fat slag. He tells Roxy and her little brothers that they don't have to listen to mum, that they can eat whatever they want, never mind what mum has cooked them. Dad doesn't like mum to go out, so Roxy and her mum and her brothers stay at home a lot. Roxy wants things to get better, but she doesn't see what could stop Dad from behaving the way he does. Childhood should be a time of nurturance and growing independence. The intrepid child, supported by loving, empathetic, consistent, and boundary-setting caregivers, should be able to explore their world. As they learn new skills and tackle new situations, the inevitable mistakes they make should be used positively as opportunities for growth. As children get to know themselves and their preferences, their rights as enshrined in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child should be respected, including their right to have a say in matters that affect them, and for their views to be given due weight. Yet perpetrators of coercive control, such as Roxy's father, are catastrophically unequipped to give children the childhood experiences they need. A perpetrator of coercive control, usually, though not always, a child's father or father figure, is singularly focused on one thing, their campaign to control their target or targets, usually the child's mother, and sometimes also the child themselves. To control their targets, coercively controlling fathers deploy an arsenal of harmful tactics: psychological abuse, manipulation, financial impoverishment, restriction of time, space, and activities, isolation, constant monitoring, and threats. Some perpetrators are also physically violent and sexually abusive. Overall, coercive control perpetrators are the most harmful and dangerous kind of domestic violence perpetrators and tend to harm their partners and children in multiple ways. We don't yet know how many children worldwide experience coercive control. When an incident of violence occurs in an intimate relationship, this doesn't necessarily mean a campaign of coercive control is happening. So our statistics on domestic violence are not ideal for understanding the true scale of coercive control. However, given what we know about the frequency of domestic violence, it is likely that millions of children globally are having their childhoods blighted by coercive control right now. Mothers and children who are subjected to coercive control feel trapped. The perpetrator has made it clear that they must meet his expectations and obey his commands, or face awful punishments. Over a long period of abuse, he will have made every effort to cut off the escape routes, psychological and practical, that mothers and children would need to leave him. He may have told the mother that if she tries to leave, he will kill her, or will make sure that she and the children never see each other again. He will have made it clear that he can get away with doing the things he threatens. His chief demand is that family life revolves around meeting his needs and keeping him happy. He has little empathy for his children or his partner. From his point of view, their needs and rights do not exist. Sometimes he may be nice to his partner or play lovingly with his children, but this is not for their benefit, it is for his. His periods of being affectionate and fun give his targets false hope that things are not that bad, reducing their ability to recognize just how abusive he really is, and increasing their entrapment. To the outside world, a coercive control perpetrator may seem like a violent, dangerous, or hostile man. Or, alternatively, he may just as easily be seen as a normal, great guy, likable, generous, intelligent, even a pillar of his community. Appearances can be very deceptive. For children living under the coercive control perpetrated by their father or father figure, childhood is a bleak and distorted version of how it should be. He may dislike it when their mother gives them love and attention and frequently demand that she stop it and focus on him instead. He may be furious when the children make noise, cause mess, or engage in carefree play at home, and make it clear that these normal childhood activities will not be tolerated. Children's healthy attempts to develop their independence by asserting their will against their parents are crushed in relation to their father. He won't allow critiques or disobedience. Children's lives are also harmed when he harms their mother. When he isolates their mother from her family and friends and makes it difficult for her to go out in the community, the children are also isolated. They may not be able to go to their friends' houses or do after-school activities if their mother is unable to take them, and opportunities to build friendships and socialize are lost. Their father may have plenty of money for himself, but leave their mother chronically poor, meaning she cannot buy the children the things they need, like nutritious food, causing negative impacts on their health. The children know that their feelings matter very little in their family. Although their mother may care deeply about them and may do her very best to look after them, there are limits to what their father will allow her to do. And, overall, it is clear to the children that family life revolves around pleasing their father. This summary of childhood under coercive control is drawn from the qualitative research interviews that I carried out in England with 15 mothers and 15 of their children who had lived with and eventually broken free from coercive control. Young Roxy, with whose story we began, is one of these children. Aged 11 when I interviewed her, and having lived apart from her father for 4 years, Roxy could well remember what life had been like during his campaign of coercive control, and what it had taken for her and her mother to begin to recover from his abuse. These interviews form the heart of this book, giving rich insights into what life was like for children and mothers, both during and after coercive control. Such insights are rare. This book is the first academic book to examine children's experiences of coercive control. The approach it takes represents a deep shift in the children and domestic violence field. We make the shift happen by asking a bold new question. The old question that has dominated children and domestic violence research for the last several decades is, how are children affected by exposure to incidents of parental violence? The new question, which this book asks, is, how are children affected by the perpetrator's campaign of coercive control, a campaign that may or may not include violence? Additionally, the book also asks, what does the road to recovery look like for children and mothers who have experienced coercive control? The mothers and children interviewed for this research explained what daily life had been like under coercive control. They reflected on what activities they had to do or could not do because of how perpetrators/fathers would react. From those interviews, a detailed picture emerged of how perpetrators/fathers' coercive control had constrained children's and mothers' actions and limited their freedoms. However, the picture was not just one of constraints. Children and mothers also bravely resisted perpetrators/fathers' abuse when and where they could, and had eventually escaped, at least to an extent. Escape was not easy, and usually required much more than separating from perpetrators. As part of their escape, survivors often had to manage family court battles over child custody and contact, ongoing threats, stalking, abuse, and violence by perpetrators/fathers, and multiple house moves. Because many perpetrators/fathers attempted to maintain their coercive control post-separation, the road taken by children and mothers toward freedom was often long and dangerous. By the time they took part in the study, most of the interviewed children and mothers had largely escaped from coercive control. They had built new lives for themselves, usually as single-mother households. A small number of mothers were in relationships with new partners. Most children's and mothers' descriptions suggested that, overall, the new lives they had built were much more positive than their life under the perpetrators/fathers' coercive control, and were helpful to their recovery and growth. This book's study of coercive control is also a study of the mother-child relationships between adult victims/survivors and child victims/survivors. Some unique features are present here. In this study, unlike previous studies, children and mothers from the same families were asked to recall how close or strained their relationships with each other had been at different points along their journeys. You, the listener, will be able to hear what happened next and understand the long-term trajectories that mothers and children experienced, some of which were ultimately very positive and hopeful. The book is organized as follows. Chapter 1 introduces coercive control in more depth, exploring its tactics, dynamics, and impacts. Chapter 2 introduces the cutting-edge and innovative approaches that this book helps to pioneer to illuminate children's experiences. Chapter 3 explains the hows, whats, whens, and whys of the interviews themselves, such as how mothers and children were contacted, how interviews were designed, and what ethical approaches were followed. Listeners who are not interested in these details can skip this chapter. Chapters 4 to 9 draw on the interviews with children and mothers to explore how their lives were affected by coercive control, and we will close this preface by outlining these chapters in a little more depth. The purpose of Chapter 4 is to show how children were both profoundly harmed by and also resisted perpetrators/fathers' coercive control. This chapter suggests that children and mothers in these circumstances should be understood as co-victims and co-survivors, who are both being harmed by the same thing, perpetrators' drive and determination to control others. Implications of this way of thinking for child protection and family courts are set out in this chapter. Chapter 5 examines how coercive control affects mother-child relationships. Here, we will hear how the differing circumstances of the different families and the precise nature of perpetrators' coercive control in each family impacts on mother-child relationships. This chapter organizes the impacts on mother-child relationships into a five-factor framework and explains how this framework can be used to understand how some mother-child relationships stayed close and supportive, whereas others became much more strained and distant. Chapter 6 picks up the story of children's and mothers' lives at the point where they had separated from perpetrators. It explores the two main difficulties that mothers and children faced post-separation. Contact between children and perpetrators/fathers that allowed perpetrators to stay in their lives and continue their coercive control. And post-separation violence, stalking, and harassment from perpetrators/fathers, which could leave mothers and children in as much danger as ever. This chapter also outlines what circumstances and types of support were required by children and mothers for them to begin to heal from coercive control and start to build new lives. Chapter 7 highlights the way in which many of the interviewed mothers and children had helped one another to recover. This was something they had done in the months and years after separating from perpetrators/fathers, through simple but meaningful forms of positive interaction with each other. Woven into the fabric of their everyday lives, their techniques for helping each other included particular methods of giving reassurance, building each other's confidence, and showing care and affection for one another. Chapter 8 gives a detailed survey of the longer-term outcomes for mother-child relationships after coercive control. These relationships in the period after separating from perpetrators/fathers are described through four patterns, named as follows. 1. Positive supportiveness, positive recoveries. 2. High-stakes support, limited recoveries. 3. Struggling relationships, struggling recoveries. And 4. Broken relationships, blocked recoveries. Each mother-child relationship in the study was characterized as experiencing one of these four patterns. Some were characterized as experiencing pattern 1, some pattern 2, and so forth. The chapter will reveal what distinctive feature characterized mothers and children experiencing pattern 1, the most positive pattern, and what this means for those who seek to support survivors of coercive control. As the book starts to come to a close, Chapter 9 provides rare insights into what mothers and children themselves wanted from their post-coercive control mother-child relationships, their views, feelings, and outlooks. Interestingly, one particular type of mother-child relationship that these survivor families had either achieved or wished to achieve was almost universally aspired to by mothers and children. The chapter will sketch out what particular, ideal type of mother-child relationship this was. Finally, Chapter 10, the conclusion to the book, provides 10 game-changing recommendations for future research, policy, and practice. These 10 recommendations, 5 for research and 5 for policy and practice, suggest the necessity for bold action in a number of key areas, including how we address perpetrators and how we understand and support children and mothers. 1. Understanding coercive control. The coercive control model of domestic violence. If a situation of coercive control were a political system, it would be a dictatorship. The coercive control perpetrator is the dictator. Dictators, able to behave with deceptive politeness on the international stage, are defined by their cruel, ruthless, and paranoid tyranny over their own people. Domestic opposition is usually banned. Contact with people from other countries is heavily restricted. Citizens are likely to be under constant surveillance. Compliance is instilled through terror and threat of punishment. In other words, life with a coercive control perpetrator is like living under one of the most oppressive governments on earth. And there are millions of these mini-dictatorships happening right now on ordinary streets, quite probably, if you live on one, on your street too. The understanding that much domestic violence is about one partner seeking to coercively control, dominate, and assert power over another has long been recognized by certain researchers, advocates, and organizations. In 2007, Evan Stark's book-length work on this subject, Coercive Control, The Entrapment of Women in Personal Life, further increased awareness of how coercive control is at the heart of the most dangerous and harmful cases of domestic violence. In that book, Stark argued that our criminal justice and social responses to domestic violence were failing victims and were in urgent need of transformation because they wrongly conceptualized domestic violence as discrete incidents or episodes of violence. This incidence of violence-based understanding of domestic violence disregards the fact that coercive control perpetrators use many other abusive tactics besides violence, including emotional/psychological abuse, monitoring and micro-regulation, isolation, and economic abuse, and they use those tactics continuously. Victims slash survivors of coercive control are therefore being constantly abused, even if there has not been an incident of violence for months or ever. Conceptualizing domestic violence as physical violence therefore leads us to underestimate the risks and harms of coercive control. It also underestimates the true extent of the damage that perpetrators are inflicting, leading to dangerously ineffectual responses. A perpetrator may have brought about a situation where his partner is living like a prisoner in her own home. Her every action controlled and monitored, deprived of her liberty, only allowed out under strict conditions, a shell of her former self, her psychological integrity in ruins, and her economic well-being drastically reduced. But because the perpetrator has not beaten her recently or inflicted any major physical injuries on her, the risk of him causing harm to her is perceived as low, and she is offered very little help. It is still overwhelmingly true across the world that, as Stark observed, there is no mechanism for criminal justice systems to recognize the enormous harm that has been caused by such perpetrators. This legal vacuum leaves them free to continue their abuse. As the work of Stark and others has highlighted, there needs to be a fundamental change, a revolution, in the ways that societies understand and respond to coercive control. The model of domestic violence as incidents of violence needs to be set aside in cases of coercive control. In its place, the coercive control model should be adopted. This model emphasizes that multiple tactics of abuse are used by perpetrators and that they use these tactics continuously. The model highlights how perpetrators' tactics have cumulative effects on victims/survivors, entrapping them, depriving them of liberty, and causing death by a thousand cuts. Tactics of coercive control. Numerous studies have helped to illuminate how coercive control operates as a severe and multidimensional form of domestic violence. Taken together, these studies have provided us with extensive information about the tactics and behaviours of coercive control perpetrators. These include emotional and psychological abuse, including screaming, belittling, mocking, insulting, humiliating, interrogating, and being contemptuous. Using a combination of affection, good times, emotional coldness and emotional cruelty as part of a system of reward and punishment to habituate the victim/survivor to behave and feel as the perpetrator wishes. Sometimes apologizing and making promises to change in order to create false hope in the victim/survivor. Denying, minimizing and blaming other people for their own abusive behavior. Undermining the victim/survivor's confidence, self-esteem, and sense of self-efficacy by continually commenting on their faults. Gaslighting the victim/survivor by encouraging them to think that they are mentally ill, or encouraging them to doubt their own memory and perceptions of reality. Forcing the victim/survivor to watch, hear, or be aware of a loved one being psychologically, physically, or sexually abused. Preventing the victim/survivor from showing their loved one's affection or giving them attention. Using abuse to make the victim/survivor highly dependent on them and then threatening to permanently separate from or be unfaithful to them. Making threats to remove children or pets from the victim/survivor if they defy the coercive control. Threatening to reveal private or personal information about the victim/survivor to others. Encouraging the victim/survivor to believe that people in their life laugh at them, hate them, or do not care about them. Manipulating the feelings of empathy, guilt, connection, and responsibility that the victim/survivor has for them, and their wish to try to help or heal them, in order to coerce the victim/survivor into acting against their own best interests. Threatening or attempting or actually committing suicide, or saying that they will die or become seriously ill due to stress or upset if the victim/survivor does not comply with them. And creating states of terror, constant worry and hypervigilance, shame and self-blame, emotional exhaustion, emotional desperation, and mental ill health in victims/survivors through sustained abusive actions. Control of time, space, and movement, including the micromanagement of the victim/survivor's daily life, routines, choices, appearance, and behavior. This may involve coercing the victim/survivor into spending more time with the perpetrator than they wish to, coercing them into life-altering actions such as marriage or relocating to a new area, making lists of activities that the victim/survivor must follow, especially around housework, restricting the victim/survivor's ability to make basic decisions for themselves, unreasonably imposing time limits on activities and setting curfews, coercing the victim/survivor into adopting particular styles of clothing, hair and makeup, controlling what the victim/survivor can eat, preventing the victim/survivor from engaging in the play or leisure activities that they enjoy, depriving the victim/survivor of resources required for normal daily life, such as access to transportation, and dictating and micro-regulating how the victim/survivor can behave as a parent. Monitoring and stalking, including through digital technology. This may involve watching and following the victim/survivor, depriving the victim/survivor of privacy, checking the victim/survivor's phone and letters to monitor their contacts and communications, monitoring the victim/survivor's online activities, phoning, messaging, and video calling the victim/survivor frequently and intrusively, and placing digital monitoring devices on the victim/survivor's person or possessions or car or home. Perpetrators may ask others, including their children, to assist them in their monitoring and stalking, or use others for this purpose without their knowledge. Sexual abuse, including rape and sexual coerciveness. Coercing the victim/survivor into sexual acts that they do not wish to take part in or find degrading, frightening or painful. Child sexual abuse. Paranoia about infidelity or sexual activity. Image-based abuse or threatening to reveal to others details of the victim/survivor's sexual health, sexual past or sexual preferences. Making the victim/survivor feel sexually degraded and dehumanized. And reproductive coercion, birth control sabotage, or coercing the victim/survivor into having or not having a child. Sexual abuse can also include coercing the victim/survivor into prostitution or unwanted sexual activity with third parties. Economic abuse, including interfering with the victim/survivor's employment, business or schooling, unfairly appropriating some or all of the victim/survivor's income, assets or savings, preventing the victim/survivor from possessing money, assets or savings, or controlling the amounts they can access, coercing the victim/survivor into excessive amounts of expenditure on gifts or days out or holidays, refusing to contribute fairly to bills, household expenses, or child maintenance, creating debt for which victim/survivors are liable, falsely or unreasonably claiming that the victim/survivor owes them money or assets, negatively affecting the victim/survivor's credit score, and involving the victim/survivor in costly legal proceedings vexatiously, That is, out of a sense of spite and to continue their control.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?